Greetings, everyone. This is Nautical Knowledge and Nonsense. In this episode, I got to sit down with my former captain, Barry King. Barry King is the captain of the engineless main windjammer schooner called the Mary Day. He was a very influential person in my tall ship career. Barry and I talk about what led him to the Mary Day, finding one's home or path in life, some leadership and boat lessons that can save your life, and what makes the main windjammer fleet so incredibly unique in the world. Hopefully by the end, you will want to be packing your bags for a wonderful, nostalgic, music and lobster-filled vacation aboard his schooner. Now here's the interview with main windjammer captain, Barry King.
Really, this interview is about, I want to know, how did you get into this, Johan? How did you become a podcaster, an influencer?
Yeah, right. I wish. Well, gosh, Bear, this interview is all about you, I thought. But if you want to start that way.
I can turn the table quite easily.
So
you know how I hate being the center of attention.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, all day with the passengers, I can only imagine.
That's right, yeah.
Long story short, I never thought I'd get into podcasting. Because the first podcast I heard, I was like, this is dumb, you know, and it was with shipmates and they're listening to it. And it was like, it does, like the person, they didn't know what they were talking about. It was pretty obvious. So I just said, this is weird. I'm never going to get involved. And then it was just a few years ago, a couple years ago, there was a shipmate who was saying, yo, and you like stories and you like, you know, that kind of stuff. He's like, you should do a podcast. I'm like, no, I'm not going to do a podcast. He's like, just do interviews. Like, that's all a lot of these podcasts are. They're just interviews. And like, you know, and you like talking to people. And so I found a couple podcasts that were more like long form interviews where they had actually, you know, people that knew what they were talking about. And I was like, oh, okay, this is actually really interesting. And I realized listening to them that the interviewer didn't necessarily know, they need to know enough, but they didn't have to be an expert in the field. So I thought, well, gosh, I mean, I'm pretty good at tall ships, but I could also interview, you know, people on merchant, like cargo ships and container ships. And I could interview, you know, one of the first things I did was I called up the Columbia River Bar, you know, Pilots Association, and a bar pilot was willing to talk to me. And so it's just like, so it's kind of like, it's stuff that I'm kind of curious about too. Like, what is it like to live on a tugboat overnight, you know, and travel for days at a time? What's it like to be a surfer and, you know, live that lifestyle? And so I figure the sky's the limits, and I'm still excited by it. And you know, I've gotten to meet interesting people, sometimes sadly only virtually. And the best part though, Barry, honest to God, the best part has been connecting with old shipmates and just hearing them say, I have not thought about these stories in years. And just knowing that over time, those stories will be forgotten, but now hopefully they won't, you know? And it hasn't been all perfect, and it's a lot of work, but that's kind of, that's what it's been like.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. So my hope, my goal is that it'll spread word about the maritime community, but mostly, you know, obviously I love tall ships. So I want people to learn about tall ships. And just get our community promoted well. Awesome. Well, Barry, may I ask you a few questions? Is that all right?
Yeah, fire away, man.
Well, so oh man, where to begin? I don't know. Can you tell people like how would you like to begin? Like because you got one of the coolest jobs ever. I mean, really, like if the wind was consistent where I lived, I'd be doing what you're doing right now. I love it. Like, you're captaining a boat, you're keeping it alive, you're interacting with passengers, you're showing them an amazing time, an amazing experience, and all doing it with relative sustainability. I mean, as good as one could get in the modern era. Like, it's incredible. And you got great sailing out there in Maine. I mean, Penobscot Bay is, I remember being told by an old shipmate who was senior editor of Wind and Boat magazine, it's the best sailing in the world for the variety of the islands, for the variety of the wind and weather. You know, he's just like, Johan, you got to go to Maine. You're going to love it, which was part of the reason I applied for you guys.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, this, like every like every diamond in the rough. This is a multifaceted story. So I grew up in the suburban ghettos of Boston, north of Boston, a town called Marblehead. I lived there until I was about 15. And, you know, I hauled lobster traps as a kid, and we had the Forrest family sailing vacations on our 32-foot sailboat in old Phillips Roads, Swift Shore. It was, yeah, we had like a 420, we had a whaler, there were just boats everywhere. And we lived right kind of in this old section of town on this rocky beach. And so you could set an outhaul and pull your skiff out. When you want to go out in your boat, you haul your skiff in and off you went. So I was on the water every day of the summer, yeah, for most of my life. And there's some part of this that is, you grow up with it, and it becomes kind of a little bit a part of who you are, your identity, my identity, certainly. You know, my father, he was captain on, did deliveries and yacht work. My brother, you know, worked on racing yachts. Yeah, we all played around in boats. So fast forward from there, I left the suburban ghettos and moved to Maine when I was 15, and haven't left, except to go to college, graduate and undergraduate school. This is that place where you land and you say, your soul says, this is home. A lot of people say, you know, when they're crossing the bridge between New Hampshire and Vermont, New Hampshire and Maine, they're like, yep, I'm home. And, this is home. In my heart of hearts, in my soul, it's like, yeah, there's a spiritual connection, I guess, on some level, with this place that, with the people and the place, the communities here, it was kind of lying here waiting for me. And as soon as I got here, it was like, yep, this is where I need to be. My background is in education. I have a degree, undergraduate degree in experiential education and a graduate degree in experiential education as well. I spent almost 6 years traveling around North America, studying everywhere and everything and with everyone. And that was a school called the Audubon Expedition Institute. And so did my graduate and undergraduate work there, finished my degrees. I tried classroom teaching. That was mind-numbing to me. I just needed to be outside. All I ever wanted to do was get the kids outside. I just couldn't do it. I felt trapped. I worked at the Museum of Science in Boston for a while, and I worked with live animal demonstrations, and I just wanted to take these critters outside, you know, and every day, you know. So being outdoors, living in the wilderness, which I did for those 6 years traveling around North America, I don't think I slept inside for that solid 6 years. I don't think I slept inside once.
No, wow.
I lived out of my backpack. When I wasn't traveling on, you know, with school, I was working on boats, yachts, and also I worked for a summer camp. We had pulling boats, and so we did these 26 day long courses where we basically left and didn't look back, and we had no itinerary and just off we went. So the yacht work I did was up here. I also did some. Took some yachts up to Newfoundland and, you know, traveled all over, but Bermuda, the Caribbean. But, you know, Maine just kept hauling on the line. And so here I am. Dan and I met in graduate school. We bought our first charter boat, which we ran as a 6-passenger boat, a wooden boat, old racing yacht. My father said, I went to graduate school in business. I learned the meaning of, you know, being undercapitalized. we went,
Just for folks listening, so Jen is your wife.
Yes, correct. Yeah. I'm sorry. Jen is.
And she's awesome. She's totally awesome.
She is one amazing human being on so many levels. Just hearing me talk, you can tell she's a saint. for putting up with that's but no, she yeah, so she and I we were doing kind of like these what I would call funky woo-woo cruises. We were doing crunchy granola, vegetarian, macrobiotic, yoga cruises, men's cruises, women's cruises. Obviously we did a lot of sail training cruises. We did sail training with blind people, which was pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
We just did all of this stuff. But the rugged part of it was with six guests, it's really hard to glue ends together when you have a mortgage. So during that time, I wound up working for one of the captains during the winter, one of the Windjammer fleet captains. And yeah, it was like I was getting $4.35 an hour. And I will never forget, we had one October where Jen and I literally lived. We lived in this little tiny one-room apartment that someone allowed us to live in for free next to these four huge power transformers that serviced the boatyard in Camden. And, we'd come out in the morning, we'd be glowing. We had this little kerosene burner that we used for heat. When we opened the windows in the spring, we looked at the walls and we realized we'd probably been smoking two packs a day all winter long.
Oh my gosh.
Black. And we literally, like, we got done with the sailing season. We had like, we had some 50 pounds back, and a few pounds of kerosene. Literally lived on that for the better part of a month until we could scrape some money together. So it was pretty humble beginnings. Yeah. So, you know, so during that time, I started working on some of the schooners. It became apparent that we couldn't afford to have both Jen and I sailing, on our boat. So I got a job as the mate on Mary Day. I was working for, Captain Steve Cobb, who was, an extraordinary captain, sail training. I mean, he was there at the advent of sail training. All of the names that you think of in the tall ship business that have anything to do with sail training, Steve sailed with. Yeah, I mean, you pick out a name, and you know, they were there. I mean, you know, people like Jan and Walter Ripka and Jan Miles and Walter Ripka and. Yeah, J.B. Smith, they all sailed together. Kip Files, you know, they all sailed together. They didn't, you know, they were making up sail training, yeah, just out of what they knew, out of the experiences they had. Yeah, Dan Moreland, they all sailed together, and they were the beginning of sail training. And sail training has been, the experiential education part of me has always wanted to combine natural history. And most importantly, sense of place. And sense of place is, to me, it is like a key ingredient to life. And I don't know how to describe that to people who may not have a sense of the word, but it is sense of place is having a sense of belonging in somewhere. It is. In the marrow of your bones, you know that that's where you are and it is the right place to be. Sense of place also has to do with understanding the cultural and natural history of a given area. Just being able to walk down the street and, you know, you identify, you know, what's going on around you like you would the neighbors in your neighborhood. You know, it's like, yeah, look at that oak tree. Yeah, she's budding out. You know, and I'm sitting here looking at the maple trees, which are actually budding out. The sap is flowing. So there's this connection to the natural history of Maine and certainly the mid-coast area that has grown over time. I worked as a naturalist for a number of years. And so my natural history background is pretty strong. My geology background was pretty strong. And so I was able to kind of take all of that and my passion, you know, certainly my passion for sharing all of this with people. And, you know, obviously sailing is it. Well, while I was traveling, I'll never forget being in the California desert. I was sitting there in Death Valley and I was sitting by the edge of this pool and there was this little desert pupfish. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but this little desert pupfish, a little tiny thing, was looking up out of the water. And I was the only one there. So I you know, kind of looked around and said, "Oh, you're looking at me." And, I assumed he was. And And I remember I was struck by, I just realized how far away I was from the ocean. I was like almost 3,000 miles from the ocean, sitting there in Death Valley. Someone told me there's a pond over the other side of the hills from Death Valley called the Pacific. I don't know. I've only sailed there intermittently, but I wanted to go
back. Oh, you want to go back to the Atlantic Ocean. Okay, I see.
Go back to the Atlantic Ocean. And that was a long ways away. And I looked at that desert pupfish and I said, thank you so much. You have just helped me realize that, you know, I need to be there. I need to be on boats. It's what I know. You know, it's what I know. It's that sense of place that I already have. It's easy to teach when you have a sense of place, because everything has a story. And after 40 years of sailing in Penobscot Bay, yeah, I've made a lot of connections with a lot of people. I've made a lot of connections with a lot of places. I mean, I have had, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to get me excited about the natural wonders around me. I mean, it's like, I get as excited today seeing a seal as I did 40 years ago. You know, I can't contain myself. You know, if we're out sailing and a seal pup, you know, we're going to see seal pups this spring. When a seal pup pops up, I'm like jumping up and down, seal pup! You know? I want everybody in the world to see that. You know, I want everybody to know, you know, how cool that is. I want them to know about, you know, how old that seal pup is and what it's, you know, what it may have been through in the journey to where it is today. And I'll say, you know, mom isn't far away. And, you know, like literally with Disney World timing, cue the seals, you know, all of a sudden mom pops up. And it's like, you know, you can't invent that stuff. It just happens. And so if you know a place, if you have that sense of place, it is far easier to be a storyteller. And people like stories more than they like education, right? Mm-hmm. But Johan, you started, you were talking about why you do podcasts, and you said, well, I know boats, you know? So that's like I can do a podcast about that because I know I have this sense. Even if it's a tugboat I've never been on, I can ask questions about that because I know what that feeling is to be, you know, to be shipping out on a boat, whether it's one you've been on before or a new one, meeting new shipmates, you know, new ports of call, all that. You know that feeling. And you can, you know, you can kind of relate that across a very broad spectrum of what I'll call the, you know, our merchant marine. And, you know, and the same thing. That's what happens for me in Maine. You know, I in my gut know this place pretty well, and not just the coast, but inland too. You know, I've traveled around the state, and it is all connected to me. And it's so easy for me to be able to teach from that place. It's just, yeah, the stories go on and on and on. And, you know, when I'm standing alone on the quarterdeck at 11 o'clock at night, and I realize I've been talking for 45 minutes and everybody just kind of drifted off the bed. I stretch that out a little long.
I was reviewing my, I kept journals during my time on well, I mean, I still consider myself a tall ship sailor. I still consider myself part of the community. But during my really, really active time as a deckhand and captain, I was pretty good at keeping journals. And I realized with Maine, it's the funniest thing because I think my few months on your boat, I mean, I don't want to say I think for the time period, I had more stories for that amount of time than just about any other time, short of my first time probably on tall ships. And yet, and I kept really meticulous journals at every time, except for Maine. I only had a couple pages worth of journal writing, maybe like four pages, but I have 40 pages in my head worth of stories. Whereas other tours, the stories aren't there. So there was definitely something. I don't know if it was just part of I got a teaching credential. And just for whatever reason, that beat the teacher out of me so badly. And it wasn't until I got onto your boat, right, you know, right after the credential, that I started to feel like a teacher again. Like I really, because I was like, okay, well now I'm committed. I'm back to tall ships and I'm committed to this. And, you know, and then it was after your ship that I got the captain's license. And so it was a real, it was a big transitional period for me. I was definitely the crazy deckhand. I mean, my God, I was out of control, but, I look back on it. It's like, geez, I was living with passion. Don't get me wrong, but it was like borderline, sometimes beyond, you know, crazy. But luckily, you worked us pretty hard. So I couldn't play too much. But man, yeah, it was incredible. And like you said, the natural environment sailing around was phenomenal. But what got to me, my first impression was the boat. You could just tell. We put so much work and so many hours into maintaining. First of all, you could tell it had been very, very well maintained, but just the attention of detail, the amount of detail. We had a very good mate, Rob. He was very good at instructing me and, you know, teaching me just the details of how to paint. But you helped too, you and Jen, and you know, the whole family helped. But yeah, the boat was just so well maintained, and the paint looked so good, and the oil and everything looked so good. And it was just so neat. And then the passengers, you know, I remember you saying one time, because there was actually a funeral. We were holding a funeral on the ship. And you said, you know, what happens is passengers, they come on and we enjoy our time together. But then some of them come back, and they come back year after year after year. And they said, you said, after a while, they're family, you know, they're family. And it gets so personal that they want to have, when they die, they want to have their ashes scattered from the merry day. It's crazy. Like, what person on a cruise ship would be like, oh, that one cruise ship, I want to go and, you know, scatter my ashes. I mean, maybe that's a thing, but it wouldn't have the same meaning as, you know, a really tight bonded crew and passenger group out in a beautiful Penobscot Bay off of a schooner without an engine. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It was just a lot of powerful moments that I had. And I'm sure for the passengers, I can only imagine. My goodness. I mean, it had to be even more incredible.
Yeah, we do have more than our fair share of returning guests, which is great. You know, it's great. It's a responsibility. You know, it weighs heavy for Jen and I to make sure that we take care of their boat. You know, we just get them all together so we can pay the mortgage and make sure our banker keeps living in the style to which they become accustomed. And you know, I mean, we really are in every sense of the word. We are caretakers. And you know, I can't tell you. So the schooner was designed and built. She was designed in 1961, and they laid the keel in June 23, 1961. At the Harvey Gammon Shipyard in South Bristol, Maine. And the drawings, the design was all done by her original owner and captain, Havilah Hawkins, Sr. Buds was an extraordinary man. We could spend a whole conversation just talking about, you know, Buds and Mary Day, his wife, and the boys, you know, Ron and Havilah Jr., Addy. They are all extraordinary people. Unfortunately, Buds and Mary have both passed away. But I had the very good fortune to spend time with them, which means a lot to me. I can't tell you how many times a summer someone comes down to the boat and they'll say, you know, this is my grandpa's boat. Some long lost relative. And I'll be like, okay. You know. People will forever remember this as the Hawkins boat. When people say Mary Day, you know, they still, you know, there are just a gazillion people around and say, oh yeah, that's the Hawkins boat, which is fine by me. You know, I will probably, you know, I'll have my time with the boat, and it's incredible. But it is the Hawkins boat. You know, that family kind of invented that boat. And even though I've been with it for 30 years, you know, longer than the Hawkins had it by a long stretch. And it's still their boat, and it's still the guests' boat. This is not about Jen and I. I'm going to refer back to that sense of place, because it is not just my sense of place that Mary Day occupies. It is it is a whole wide-ranging community of people whose sense of place includes Mary Day. After, you know, this is her 60th birthday this year. She and I were launched only a few months apart, and there's a long story that goes with that. But wow. We won't talk about how keels get laid. we'll save that for another conversation. But at any rate, yeah. So we really do caretake something that's far larger than we are. It is a. On some level, I hate that responsibility. It's like, I just want to sail the boat my way, you know? But no, you got to have, you know, everything flying and, you know, you got to put up all the flags. I'm like, no, I just, you know, I don't want to, I just like hiding 125-foot long, you know, sparred length schooner in the main coast is not easy to do. You know, when everyone else goes left, I go right. Because my whole shtick with my guests is let's get away from everybody and everything. And having sailed the coast for 40 years on yachts and pulling boats, I can tuck Mary Day into some places that most people would just shake their heads and say, how did you ever get in there? Or you ever get out? Because every place I sail into, I have to think about, okay, I sailed in, can I sail out? Without a motor, you know, without an engine, it's, yeah, there's no guarantee you're going to turn the key in the morning and the yawboat's going to start. So, yeah.
I remember you getting a, oh, wow. Well, even the last time I was in Maine, every single schooner, because we had there was a big gathering of all the schooners. And I saw the Mary Day going, and there was like this, it looked really shallow on the chart. I'm like, oh man, well, Barry's, he'll probably turn or tack or nope. You just went right through that channel. I was like, oh, Barry knows what he's doing, but nobody else did. But I do recall.
The beauty of coasting schooners is that they have centerboards.
Ah.
So, you know, coasting schooners traditionally, here in New England, our centerboard model boats. And so we draw 7.5 feet. So I can go into places that you'd be like, yeah, never, boat's never going to fit in there. And it's like, you know.
Yeah.
If I'm only drawing 7.5 feet, I can actually tuck into some pretty tiny little places and tight. You know, places they blow my mind. And every year I find someplace new to sail into, and I did. I found a little side harbor this summer, the very last cruise that I went into, and I was just like, there was no one there. It was this little tiny arm of water that went up into this, you know, it kind of went up into this harbor, and there's this little tiny arm, and no one was up in there. And I said, I wonder if we can get up in there. And, you know, we came in, and our momentum carried us. Oh, goodness, you know. 5-6 boat lengths before we slowed down.
Wow.
And it was beautiful mud, and there was not a lot of room to swing. but there was just enough. And I was anchored in like 10 feet of water. So how much chain do you need in 10 feet of water, right?
No, yeah, not much at all. Jeez. Yeah, well, that's great. Exactly.
So, yeah, so every year I find something new. I find a new challenge. Every year it is awesome for me to see new crew, you know, learn how to handle topsails. I mean, that's the hardest thing I think people have to learn is, you know, topsails. You think they don't look that complicated, but you got to know which string to pull on it, you know, at which time. And
Furling of them. I mean, I just remember the furling was like, it was like an art form and a physical, like, you know, like I remember one time just getting so angry at that topsail because it wouldn't furl, right? It was, but boy, they saved us though. I don't know if you remember, but when I was on Mary Day, we had the great schooner race, and I forget which boat was our competition because there was only one other boat that was in our class. I forget the
name
of
it. Probably American Eagle is generally sales in our class.
Was it Eagle? Okay. Yeah, but I just recall they had the lead. Like, we were like one of the last boats to leave the anchorage, and they were definitely in the lead. And then they cut around the lee of this island, and you could see it was calm. I mean, there was there was definite wind shadow from the island, and they just tried to cut, because we were gaining on them, and they tried to cut through that lee, through that calm water, and just got stuck. They like stuck and just stopped all momentum because lack of wind. And we had those topsails, and you just kind of skirted right at the little wisp of like wind line, and only our topsails were filled, like nothing else. The lower, you know, the main and the fore and all that did nothing. It was just the topsails that had just the slightest little bit of air that kept us, gave us steerage, and we got around there, and then we caught a breeze nobody else caught. We were miles ahead of everybody, miles. And it was just like one of the coolest things. I was like, that made all the furling of the topsails and everything. That was worth it. For that one moment, I was like, this was totally worth it. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. They are knowing what those topsails can do. Yeah, it's when you don't have a motor, you know.
Yeah, and for nerds out, for schooner nerds out there, they're gaff topsails. So they're not like square rigged topsails. It's not a square, there's no square sails on the Mary Day. It's their gaff rigged fore and aft topsails.
Yeah, Mary Day is a little bit we have a wonderful stability picture, if you will. She has cast iron ballast keel, and she has internal ballast, and she has the stability to do a coastwise route. And that is pretty cool. It's, she stands up in a breeze, and, you know, those topsails, I think we were talking about topsails. I now remember where I was going. So the topsails, one of the things that is unique for Mary Day is that we carry a fore topsail, fore topsail. And I won't say it's a rarity. But there aren't too many other, there's no other schooners in Penobscot Bay that carry fore topsails. Yeah, most schooners from away that I've seen don't, you know, unless it's a private yacht. Very rarely do you see a fore topsail, and that's, you know, it's not overly complicated, but there are more strings, mm-hmm. and there's more rigging in the way that you have to kind of work your way around. The triadic and the freshwater stays, as well as the spring stays. So it's, yeah, playing with those topsails is, yeah, it's a lot of fun for the crew. And I just love seeing them get a chance to play with those sails. I love it when we sail and I like doing what I call window shades, where the tack of the topsails goes up simultaneously and down simultaneously. And, you know, I've had other captains say, wow, that's crisp. And, you know, you can make an art form out of something that, you know, other people might say, it doesn't matter. And I was like, well, it does. You know, let's do this so it actually looks really neat to people who are, you know, and so it's not just about that it looks neat. It requires it requires communication and timing and understanding of what you're doing. And all of those things, you know, help build a stronger crew. They gain a sense of situational awareness with each other, because it all happens without talking. You know, you've never heard me say, you know, ready about. I don't say that. I might say about, just so that people know something's going to happen. But unless I'm going to piss off the galley, I don't usually, you know, announce that we're coming about. The crew knows, you know, they have this situational awareness, that we cultivate, I feel something's different with the boat. We must be coming about. And people respond. They know exactly where to go and where to be and what to do. That to me, when I see crew who are gaining that level of situational awareness, And as you pointed out, attention to detail. I think those two things, situational awareness and attention to detail, are two things that will inevitably save someone's life. I can say that with all the confidence in the universe. Everything is in the details. You can make some big mistakes, and recover. But oftentimes it's a little detail that will just, you know, trip you up without even knowing it's coming. And you're just like, oh, you know, if I'd have just checked that shackle pin, you know, it's just examples of it I can think of over and over again, but I think if I work the crew on anything, it is attention to detail. Work is that every single thing you touch matters, right? Because it does. You know, it's not, you can't leave it to someone else. It's the intellectability of working on tall ships, is that everything you do is important. And that could be in the galley, that could be on deck. It's that every single thing you touch, every single thing you do, that mindset of what I am doing is important. Is, you know, that is, to me, that is that intellectability, as I say, that tall ships, it's an intellectability of accountability. You know, you will be held accountable sooner or later. The sea will hold you accountable. The boat will hold you accountable. and if you you might end up holding yourself accountable, which we don't want to do. Johan, you've probably heard me say in a joking way, you know, I don't mind you getting hurt. It's just all the paperwork.
Right.
It is true. You know, who wants to fill out all that paperwork, right?
No, but so, yeah, no, yeah. It's obviously more of that. I mean, you had a lot of great lessons. I remember I got so many good seamanship lessons. I got so many good leadership lessons. I do remember that attention to detail. I remember the crew, like you said, where we just would look at each other and we knew what was going to happen. That was, and made it happen. That was without even talking. That was really, really cool. But yeah, like just the other day, just 2 days ago, I got a new job and I'm working as a bartender at a brewery. And, you know, I was looking around doing, you know, like doing various tasks. And the person who was in charge of me, she said, "You have really good attention to detail." I was like, "Well, thank you." You know, and then, you know, we start talking about boats and I just explain like, yeah, on a ship, like that attention to detail can keep you alive and make all the difference in the world. So those lessons do carry over to land. But I do recall when we were on Merry Day, I remember one time, and it must have been in the summer. It was like when we were getting pretty darn tired, and I remember just waking up and like, you know, I couldn't almost feel my hands, like I was just so sore and from all the hard work. And we had wrapped up a voyage with the passengers, and you had a whole, you know, there's a big long checklist of things that have to get cleaned, things that have to get stowed, restocked, all this stuff. And we were doing that, and we were only about halfway through, maybe even less. And it was one of the sails I was tying up, and like I left like 2 inches of tail on the knot I tied, as opposed to the you know, probably four or six that I needed. But I left 2 inches, and I was, and I'll be honest, I was just being lazy. I was being lazy, not doing attention to detail. Rob came over, the mate came over. He's like, "Johan, you need to put 6 inches." Like, "Wah, rah, rah." You know, I gave him some gruff or something, and he got really mad at me, and then, you know, he went over, and you, Barry, just, I mean, I got so many leadership lessons from you. You know, you talked to Rob and you gave him the rest of the time off. You said, "Rob, you need to go. You're exhausted. You're tired." And then you came over to us. I'm like, "Oh man, we are going to get such a lecture right now. Like, I totally screwed up." And you said, "Guys, thank you. Thank you so much for all the hard work you've been doing." I was like, "What? What's going on?" You know, and I said, "No, Barry, Rob was right. Like, I wasn't, you know, that knot, I should have had 6 inches of tail. I only had 2. I was being lazy. Like, Rob was 100% correct." He's like, "Johan, we're all tired." Like, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but it was like, it was just simply, you said, you know, "Rob needs a break. We all need breaks. Let's just take some time and we'll get it done. We'll get the job done. But right now, let's just, you know, recenter." I forget how you put it, but it was basically like, you know, get recentered and then get back to task, which we did. But it was like, I don't know. There were several moments like that where just the real leadership came through, which I definitely took to heart. And and have used in my career. It's been great.
So, you know, leadership is a funny thing. I think I've read, you know, all sorts of leadership books. I think leadership is a function of circumstances. You know, what circumstances are you in? How much accountability is going to land on your shoulders in any given moment? Like what really is, if you will, at risk or you know, yeah, what is at risk at any given moment? You know, is a tail on a, you know, not, you know, should we really get excited about that? Well, probably not, but you know, there may be a lesson in there somewhere that may have some real value for someone. So I can tell you my own evolution as, you know, as a captain and with trying to be a leader has been tortured. Yeah, I will never claim to be a good leader. I do the best I can. But I think the best leaders have, what I've tried to cultivate over time is my own self-awareness. You know, why am I saying what I'm saying? Why am I feeling what I'm feeling? And that requires, for some of us, not for everybody, but for some of us human beings, that requires wrestling with some pretty, some pretty slippery gorillas. You know, we all come from different places and we all, you know, yeah, we are all just from such different backgrounds. And I never make assumptions, even like in conversations. It's always really important to me to follow up on conversations. Don't just have a conversation, you know, follow up on it. Make sure that, you know, we each heard each other, right? I wish I had been a better natural leader. You know, I learned old school where, you know, you barked at people and, you know, deckhands were not paid to think. And yeah, I'll never forget. I was sailing with the captain and the deckhand said, but I thought, and he said, you aren't paid to think. Like, okay. And he was old school, you know, he learned from a sailing master who had apprenticed, literally had apprenticed, on a four-masted schooner back in the day to another sailing master who had apprenticed back in the day to another sailing master. I mean, it is this long chain of dysfunction, I guess. it's this long chain.
Yep.
it is. There's a lot of dysfunction to it. I mean, there was always a reason for it. You know, it didn't just pop out of nowhere, but the reasoning, as time has gone by, our reasoning needs to change. There's still the intellectability of accountability. I mean, the sea will hold us accountable, and she will not say it nicely, necessarily. So there is that ultimate accountability that I pray for everyone who I sail with. Especially if I'm the captain, I pray that I'm able to communicate with them and be an example of attention to detail, of a thoughtful movement, you know, around the boat, situational awareness, all those things that, you know, that make, I think a great, you know, someone. So it's a difference between someone who knows how to tie knots and pull strings and someone who's a really great sailor.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because someone has, I sailed on a tall ship and I know which string to pull. And I'm like, great, you know, I can teach a monkey to do that. tell me who you are as a person. Tell me who you are as a human being. And, you know, Johan, you brought so much passion and joy to Mary Day. The summer you were with us, it was like, yeah, I mean, you, who you are and how you are with people, your thoughtfulness is like, that's what I want. That's what inspired the rest of us, is just who and how you are. And that was true for all the crew we had. You know, it's how people, you know, how do we treat each other? You know, how do we build that team? How do we demonstrate leadership? Because leadership comes in as many different forms as there are people and situations to put them in. There is no one you know, there is no one style of leadership that works across the board. So cultivating a variety of leadership skills has been part of my mission. Is, you know, everybody learns differently, and that's a great thing about being an educator. You know, people learn in different styles. So, you know, some people got to learn hands on. Some people, you know, they can read a book and say, "Oh, now I get it." Yeah. So leadership has been it has been probably something I've beaten myself up for more than I've needed to. But to me, it's a quality that I continue to work on all the time. How can I be a better captain? How can I take better care of my crew? How can I be a better person? How can I leave a mark, you know, that is going to be meaningful for my crew, for our guests, for everyone? So that's pretty important stuff to me. It's, as you know, I mean, you saw it.
Yeah. Well, and I gotta say, I mean, not every captain would have allowed me to, you know, interact with the passengers the way you did. Cause I mean, we're almost an hour into this interview. People listening probably barely know what exactly is the boat does, but one of the cool things about the boat, so they bring on passengers for 3, 5, 7 day long voyages. Some of them are themed, some of them are not. It's been 10 years, so I don't know what's changed. But at the time, you know, one of the cool things is there's usually at least one or two evenings where you'll sit down with all the passengers, and the Mary Day has this beautiful, you know, kind of main cabin where you know, everybody sits in the morning, like all the passengers can sit and have a meal and watch the cooking and the wood stove. And there's a wood stove there. And supposedly correct me if I'm wrong, Barry, but that the main hold area where the passengers sit and stuff, it was designed so that four couples could waltz together. Is that true? That's what I was told. Three couples. Okay, so three, yeah. Enough room.
So that a few couples could waltz. You know, the lease of the tables that fold down, they make more room.
Oh, yeah. So
you know, the distance between the wheel and the cabin house on the quarterdeck, if you looked at any other coasting schooner on the planet, there would not be 6 feet between the wheel and the binnacle. Well, it's why, you know, it's why we have to steer by points, because you can't see the little numbers on the compass. You have to steer by points because that's all you can see.
Yeah.
Yeah, wait till you reach ripe old age. And, you know, I got a pair of binoculars to see the compass. It's that quarterdeck, you know, I've called square dances on that quarterdeck, you know, circle dances. And it's you know, it's a cool thing. Yeah, we love music. We love entertaining. And, you know, I don't like to think of it as entertaining as much as I do. I love engaging people. It's all about engaging people in what's happening.
Yeah. And that's how I feel too. And I think that's probably why, because yeah, you'd let me like lead a song. And you know, after my time on Mary Day, I memorized a few of them because you had a few great poems memorized. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to memorize that. But I remember like I had my parents, I can't remember if I went home, but I got my kilt. Cause like I had the Scotsman, there was a song that I always loved singing. But you'd let me kind of lead the show for a little bit. And then, but obviously it was your show. But it was so nice that you would let me kind of entertain the crowd and let us all participate. And not every captain would do that. Not every entertainer would do that. I think a lot of people, I don't know if it's a lack of, I don't know. I don't want to speculate as to why. But maybe it's that like your attitude was, yeah, it's all about the engagement. And I agree. Like it's if somebody's got a great song or a great poem or a better singing voice than me, then I want to hear it. You know, it's so cool.
That doesn't take much with the way I croak, but it's most everybody has a better song voice than me. So.
Yeah. And I know. I don't want to bring up too sad a memory, but the cook that you guys had prior. Like I remember some passengers coming up to me and they said, "Johan, like we are so thankful that Barry's still playing music and that he was, you know, that allowing the crew to sing." And because a lot of them were concerned, you know, and I forget the cook's name. I'm so sorry. I forgot her name.
Her name was Mary. And she and
Mary, yeah.
Mary, the accordion, and Mary and I had, we we've known each other for a long time. I played music with Mary. She played the piano accordion, a small version of a piano accordion. And she and I had played music probably 20 years prior to her coming aboard the boat.
Oh, wow.
We had played contra dance music together and with some mutual friends. And Mary and I would, we would sit in the galley and we could play for hours and not repeat a song. Yeah, we could go nights and not repeat a song. We knew a ton of music. Part of my background in graduate school was studying folk music, so I had collected a few songs and stories and. So losing Mary, she unfortunately passed away from cancer shortly after our sailing season ended. That was a huge, when you lose a shipmate, Johan, I think so many of us have been through that process of, we've lost a shipmate, or I wouldn't wish it on anyone, but when you lose a shipmate, when you lose someone you've been out there with, cheek to jowl, if you will, and that is a phenomenal bond that, it transcends. I have crew from my very first year aboard the schooner who were coming back, and I remember them clear as day. Martha Newell was a cook. Lenny Bellett was my first mate. he was awesome. Aaron Ezzie, he was one of my first deckhands, and he came back and helped us last summer. He just wanted to come back part of the boat, and it was just like, he came back. I'm like, Aaron, I love you. It's like so cool to see him. And this tall ships are, the power of tall ships is not just in the wind. It is in the people who bring those tall ships to life, who bring, they bring life to life, really. Think about it. It's like, it takes, what could be ordinary and makes it extraordinary. That you're doing this, keeping these stories alive, is really cool. It's important stuff. And if it just gets us to acknowledge the importance of being connected to each other, of being, connected to what's going on in the natural world, then that's, mission accomplished, my friend.
Well, thank you, Barry. I want to bring up, do you remember the frat boys? Do they still go sailing? They have, we were talking about leadership earlier, and they had a leadership sail with I forget what the frat was. It was like Delta Chi Delta or something?
Yeah, it was Delta Tau Delta. They chartered with us for a good solid 10 years. And then unfortunately the funding source dried up. It wasn't a function of whether they wanted to do it, just the funding source dried up. But they had a funding source for 10 years, for more than 10 years, actually, where they would take members of different chapters from around the country. And there were several different experiences those people could have, but one of them was, a leadership academy aboard Mary Day. And that was an extraordinary process, because we challenged those young men to get out of their comfort zone. Get out of their comfort zone to, some of them had never seen a boat before. Some of them, like when you come from the middle of Kansas, it is like,
Well, and then swimming around the boat every morning, and going running ashore, and that was the warm up for the day.
It was extraordinary for me to see the change, the cultural change, in those young men over time, over 10 years, was really extraordinary to see the way people approached life. It changed. There's no better or worse to it. But it was really, my 10th year was very, very different from the first year.
How so?
Excuse me?
How so exactly?
Well, I'll boil it down to this. In the first year, people weren't as concerned about identifying their needs, I'll say. They just, if we said, let's go run a dip, they were like, yeah, let's do this. And they didn't think about what the impact was going to be. Like, you know, they're like, yeah, let's go do this. And we would, and we'd go do it. And, you know, and they were all for it. They were just like, yeah, bring it on. You know, bring on the challenge. And the 10th group, you know, there's a cynical part of me who said they didn't have that same sense of gung-ho, you know, like, oh, yeah, let's, you know, jump overboard. They were like, well, let's think about this for a second. Why, you know, why am I going to do this? You know, what's the value of this, you know? They were far more intelligent in some respects about why they were doing what they were doing. And like I say, you know, there's good to both of those. It's good to be thoughtful about why do you do the things you do. It's also great to be like, you know what? This is going to be a blast. I'm doing it. And, you know, launching yourself off into low Earth orbit, you know, without checking to see if you have a parachute first. So, you know, there was a beauty to both of those. You know, I'm a little more of a hey, you know, let's just do this thing. You know, I think that's how the Windjammers here in Penobscot Bay survive anyways. I mean, if you actually put it down on paper, the business model, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, nuts. You know, that can't be done.
You're gonna do what? Wait, no engine? Yeah. What? No. What are you thinking? Why?
So it's
yeah.
You know, but here we are, you know, wow, what are we, you know, this been 80 years it's been 80 years since schooners reinvented themselves up here in the Maine coast to become passenger carrying vessels, you know, and no one helped them do it. There's no, you know, we're for profit mom and pop, you know, every single one of us is individually, you know, owned by mom and pop. You know, there's real people, you know, when you get aboard, it's real people right there at the wheel. The owners, you know, it's our house on the line. It's our kids who are aboard. It is, you know, what happens here with the Windjammer fleet, defies some amount of gravity. We don't apply for grants to get a rebuild or anything like that. I mean, we got to go to the bank and justify it, you know, and get the bank to lend us money. And, you know, if we need to do work and then, you know, and then you pay it back or you just save, you know, you save that money, you know, get a suit of sails is, you know, if anyone's been around boats, you know, a suit of sails for a merry day would be, I can't even, you know, north of 60 grand.
Yeah. It's, you know, oh, it's crazy.
Mainsail alone is 15 grand. Right. So,
yeah.
You know, so when we put those sails away at the end of the season, don't you know they're drier than a boot, and you know, they get put in their own special most proof building. Uh-huh. You know, they're at the global headquarters. The fact that this is the last, at least in this country, it's the last and largest fleet of working sailing vessels, commercial sailing vessels in the country.
Yeah.
You know, outside thousands of Egypt, you know, maybe in the Western Hemisphere. Well, they're in the Eastern Hemisphere, but you know what I'm saying. It's just there are not many fleets of commercial working sailing vessels.
Oh yeah, no, it's phenomenal. And what amazed me too is how the ships really, in many ways, supported each other. You know. Like that the business models were relatively the same, but it wasn't like you guys were competing. It was simply, let's just make these experiences as amazing as possible, encourage people, you know, like, oh, you can't go on our boat, go on this other ship, check it out. Like, it was, I felt like there was real cooperation between the schooners. On a practical level, like actually like, oh, we're going to sail here and oh, you're going here, I'm going to go here and da, da, da. But also in a business sense, it was more of a, let's make the pie bigger than this is my piece of the pie. This is it. I'm eating this. And there wasn't a lot of that I saw anyway, as a deckhand.
Yeah, no. And you're right. There is a level of cooperation among competitive businesses that also is uncommon. So the Maine Windjammer Association is an advertising and marketing cooperative. That's, you know, we have our membership, which is most of the schooners in the Windjammer fleet here in Penobscot Bay. And yeah, so we advertise cooperatively, we market, do marketing stuff, we get travel writers, whatever. We do it all cooperatively because, the fleet has tried doing it the other way. And what ends up happening is you start clubbing each other over the head. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, the bay is too small. The harbor is too small. It's a lousy way to have to live. I can tell you it's no fun. And
yeah.
It is also difficult for the world to understand what's going on. Like it's easy to confuse the media when someone says, well, you know, if you have two different, you know, groups of owners trying to get the same travel writer, well, we're better than they are. Well, what makes you better? We're better than they are. There is no better.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're all different. Every boat has the personality of its captain. And there are people, you know, who swear by Mary Day, and there's people who swear at Mary Day. And that's okay. You know, I don't feel like I need to be all things to all people, as much as my fragile little ego would like to be, but it's this cooperative work that we do together, that I think allows us to survive. I remember one of the boats, had an incident where, you know, one of the spars was broken. Mm-hmm. And I was on the landline to a friend on shore getting them to pull together some Douglas fir to build a new spar over the weekend.
Oh, wow.
It happened, you know. So I'm like, they're my competition, right?
Wow.
But God, does my heart go out to anyone who has, you know, some kind of a mishap. We have a lot of the boats have Yanmar, four-cylinder Yanmars up here. So mm-hmm. I have an alternator, I have a starter, I got, you know, we all carry spares, enough spares so that if anyone has an issue out there, you know, we can rebuild a Yanmar somewhere out in the middle of Penobscot Bay. That wasn't intentional. It just wound up that way, but we all know that we have parts and we're all more than willing to help each other. You know, guy lost his starter motor last summer, you know, and had a charter. He's going out the next day and he's like, it's a Sunday, no one's open. You got a starter motor? I said, yeah, matter of fact, I do. And I gave him the starter motor. He slapped it in. You know, he was waiting for one to come, you know, by Pony Express. And when it did, he returned the one that I gave him and all was good. You know, he made a living. We made a living. And we built a friendship.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool. So that is the spirit with which, by and large, we operate up here in Maine, because we're it. You know, we're it. The Coast Guard doesn't get us. They. I will never forget. So you know, I got my sailing master's whatever license, and I was down at the REC, the Regional Exam Center in Boston, and I'll never forget. It's like my 500 ton or whatever. And I go up and I say, you know, this says, auxiliary sail on it. You know, it says sail power, steam, you know, or it said, motor power, steam, whatever. It's auxiliary sail. And I said, can you put sail on here? And the guy looked at me. I'll never forget Bert Russell. He was the head of the REC. Burt Russell looks at me and he says, "What do you want that for?" And I said, "Well, you know," I said, "you know, what if I'm on a boat that doesn't have a motor in it?" He said, "Ah, there's none of those left anyway." And the joke was on him, because about 5 years later, Burt wound up as the captain of the port in Portland, sector northern New England, and he wound up being in charge of inspecting the largest fleet of non-motorized vessels sailing. And I was like, "Oh my God!" I said, "Burt, you remember me?" So he did. He put the safe endorsement on there, and it's like, you know, it's like it didn't. It only meant. I mean, it only meant something to me in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care at this point. You know, if they can, you know, some one of my friends was taking a class once. You know, he was captain aboard the Victory Charms, and I'll never forget the guy in the class. You know, they were taking a radar class, whatever. And the guy, you know, everyone's talking about what they do. And he says, "Yeah, well, I got this, you know, 150-foot, whatever, three-masted schooner, the oldest, you know, three-masted schooner, in the United States, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and she doesn't have an engine." And the guy, the head of the class, he said, "You can't do that." And my friend said, "No, you can't do that. I can." It's kind of like, "Oh, yeah, you know," and it's like, you know, and it's, yeah, we can do that. You know, it's what we do all the time. It's what we do every day, you know. So it just, you get used to it. So what we do up here, we do together, because we know that we live. We live and die together, because the Coast Guard is going to make up something new, you know, every day. And just too much of what we do is not in subchapter T. It just doesn't exist. You know,
yeah.
Wood burning stoves. Who puts a wood burning stove on a wooden boat? What are you, nuts?
Right. Yeah. But it works. It works great.
It's like you do the appropriate heat lagging and. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a manned space. There's someone there all the time. You know, it's.
You got CO detectors. You got fire detectors, CO detectors. Yeah, it's safer than most people's houses. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's like, you know, we have watches. We do all the stuff that, you know, we do everything, you know, to keep. What good does it do if we lose our boats? That's bad for business, you know?
Yeah.
So we do, you know, we are usually ahead of the curve in terms of best operating practices for traditional vessels. Yeah, there is a mountain of experience here. You know, if you were to add up all the years of wooden vessel maintenance and repair up here in Maine, it would be mind-boggling. And it's cool, you know. That's the culture of where we live. And so, where do you live right now?
I'm in the Pacific Northwest.
So I'm thinking like Port Townsend, you know, places like that. That, you know, the culture is boats.
Yeah.
You know, and the culture, yeah. and you know, I believe in Port Townsend you have wooden boats, right?
They have the Wooden Boat Festival every year. And exactly. And the shipyards there do wooden boat repairs and construction, but that was my first. Oh man, Barry, one of my first times as captain, I was in the Wooden Boat Festival in Port Townsend, and like just you know, totally wet behind the ears, like completely, you know, new captain, and they gave me the race course track. They're like, "Okay, this is the course you're going to follow." And so I was like, "Okay." So I was there, and I was leading the pack, and I was going to follow the race course track, and I look behind me and I see all the schooners kind of veering off and doing their own thing. We were the only square rigger. I was on Lady Washington, so we were the only square rigger, but we were a wood boat, so we're allowed there. But all these schooners are going off in other directions, and then I look ahead of me and I just see hundreds. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. Hundreds of little sailboats. And by then I was committed. I'm like, "Oh God." And so I followed the racetrack, and it was one of the most stressful things I ever went through. And I, at some points I'm just like, "I hope nobody hits me. Like, I can't, I can't do anything. And needless to say, I did not follow that track the second time. Like, we were supposed to go around in a circuit. I'm like, no. So I learned my lesson. If everybody else is doing one thing, you really need to figure out why they're doing it before you go off and follow the rules, you know?
So. Oh, yeah. You know, well, you remember being on the schooner.
Oh, yeah.
Getting in and out of Camden Harbor.
Oh, that was great. Yeah, oh, my gosh. And the docking and
a 10-pound boat and a 5-pound bag.
Oh, it was wild. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, that narrow channel. I had one old shipmate, Otis, who he was on the Louis R. French next door. But
I remember.
Yeah. But when we were there with there's no boats in the harbor, right? No boats in Camden in wintertime. And so I remember we were going sailing around and Otis was like, man, Johan, like, I can't imagine, you know, how are we going to get out of here with all these crab pods and stuff? I'm like, oh, no. Those aren't crab pods. Those are mooring balls. He's like, what? I'm like, yep. Yeah. They're going to have boats attached to them. It's like, oh, my gosh. But yeah, so it was pretty, pretty exciting. It was exciting. But yeah, you know, there's a channel. You know, it's tight, but you never seem to have a problem with it.
they give me the minimum channel is 40 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow, that's I only
take up 32 of those feet, so I got a ton of space.
Oh yeah, jeez, yeah.
And people wonder why I always wear brown pants.
Oh my gosh, that was so cool. Well, I wish we had the wind. I wish we had the wind you guys had, because that's probably the biggest thing holding back the Pacific Northwest from having something similar to the Windjammer pasture fleet, just because you have to have an engine. There's no way. Like, I'm looking out the water right now, and it's a dead calm. And, you know, usually for my particular neck of the woods here, it's either really calm. You know, more times than not, it's really calm or really, really windy. It's one of those two. And very rarely, yeah. You know, it just wouldn't be comfortable for passengers. And that's not true. I don't want to put people off the San Juans are amazing. Oh my gosh. And the islands, the sound, and it's incredible. It's just for sailing. It's trickier. It'd be a lot trickier, I think, is the way to put it. Not uncomfortable. That's not fair, but just tricky. So,
yeah.
And it's just not consistent enough. You'll have weeks where there's no, you know, there's no wind or too much wind. And yeah, we can't do what you guys do. I wish we could. I really do. I would. I'd be figuring out what boat to get and making it happen. But
yeah, well, we have a deal. You know, we have an annual sacrifice. You know, we burn a skip.
Oh, really?
At the harbor, and that's a sacrifice to the wind gods. And and then during, you know, most of July and August, you know, we, as you experienced, we get the afternoon sea breeze. So it's calm in the morning. We get a chance to go ashore, go for a hike, go for a walk, you know, see a little fishing village or whatever, you know. And then about 11 o'clock, the wind comes up, blows 10 to 15. By 10 o'clock that night, the wind has died down and we have a calm evening at anchor. And wash, rinse, repeat. We just keep doing that. So as you know, it's like, so, you know, you just got to find the right skiff to burn. Got to make the sacrifice.
Yeah. And then the sails are so cool, folks. If you haven't had a chance, just go on a 5-day voyage. 5-day voyage is perfect. Just you'll love it. Like, if you really love it, you'll be doing the 7-day voyages guaranteed. But like, they do lobster bakes. I mean, the lobster bakes were so crazy awesome. They were really cool. And, you know, like, people go ashore and you have, I can't even describe it. Like, and then at night with the lanterns, that there's no electric lights. It's just lanterns. It feels like going back in time in the best possible way. It's just such a wonderful, wonderful escape. I remember you, one of the first things you tell the passengers when they all, you know, you have like the first morning breakfast, I think. And I think that's when you do it. And you kind of tell all the passengers, like, guys, you know what? Let's just leave the cell phones and the laptops. Just give them a rest. They need a rest too. Just try to enjoy these moments. And you know, it's, I feel like more, yeah, like pretty much everybody, almost everybody did. It felt like a vacation, you know, as in you can get away from just the craziness and the hecticness of the technology.
Yeah, so, as we call it, it's a chance to do some digital detox.
Well, there you go.
It is. It's, you know, it is. Yeah, it just, yeah, we have very few rules on the boat, but, you know, one of my longstanding rules has been, you know, if you want your battery to be charged at the end of the week, turn it off at the beginning of the week. And, and my other rule is, you know, we don't talk politics, we don't talk religion, and we don't talk about professional sports.
All right.
Too much passion involved with all of those topics.
So true. So very true. Yeah.
But it's, what we do is extraordinary. It is something that, unfortunately, we're too well kept a secret. As we like to say, we used to say we were the second greatest show on earth. But I don't think Ringling Brothers is running anymore.
Ah.
So that makes us number one.
Well, Barry, I really...
Greatest show on earth. That's us.
Well, I hope the word's able to get out about this episode and the podcast and just get people excited and just to try something new. Because, I think it's coming, people are obviously, they've been cooped up for a while. I can think of no better thing than going out on a schooner with no engine and just go exploring and having new experiences. Like, that's just the coolest. But Barry, I want to say, I try every episode to bring up something really dumb I did. So if I may.
Why?
Well, because it's just a thing. I don't want to sound like one of those. I hate it when people make themselves sound out to be all that great and all that. And you don't really know where they came from. You know, like everybody had to learn somewhere. And to this day, I don't know how I rationalized it. I know I rationalized in my brain. Like, in my brain, I thought I was doing the greatest thing. I literally do not know what I was thinking anymore. It was the dumbest thing I could have done. But we had just rigged, we hadn't had a sail. Oh, I forget the name of the boat now. Oh, one of the things, folks.
Rosie.
Was it Rosie that with the little cat? Was it cat sail? I can't remember.
She's a Harrishoff. She was built as a livery tender by the Harrishoff manufacturing company. And she's built in 1930s. And,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, we still have her.
Oh, wow. Well, so they have these wonderful little wooden boats that are for rowing, and this one had a sail rig. So when folks on the listening, when you go on the schooner and go ashore, you get rowed ashore. Like, you actually get rowed ashore, and the boat beaches or goes up to a dock, and then you leave the vessel, the little rowboat. But one of them had Rosie. You could put a little mast in and have a little sail and go sailing. And so we had just done that. I can't remember why. It hadn't been rigged for a while. And so Rob and I, we got it together and rigged it. And then I did a little test drive around the boat. Rob's like, yeah, looking good. And I somehow took that to mean I can leave the boat, go say hi to this Irish, because there's been this Irish couple that had been at a previous anchorage, or go say hi to them, talk to them for a bit, and then come back, spend 40 minutes or a half hour, some stupid amount of time. Somehow my brain, and the context is, it was the most stressful time on the ship, because it was the big final meal, and you had to clean that up, and then there was going to be entertainment, and there's all these things going on. And so I was just caught up in my own little world, and I come back to the boat, and I very quickly realized, once I looked into the galley and I saw the captain, I saw you like frantically, washing dishes and stuff. I'm like, oh God, I'm in trouble. I screwed up. I don't know what I was thinking. And you came out, and you were very intense, sir. You were very intense, but you didn't yell at me. Your voice didn't get raised. There was just an incredible level of intensity there. And it wasn't even what were you thinking? It was just you cannot do this. This is the most, this is a vital time. Your crew needs you, blah, blah, blah. The pastors need you, all this stuff. I'm like, yes, sir. Yes, sir. No problem. Understood. And just, I worked my butt off. Oh my God. That's so hard. And then to your credit, so you didn't yell at me. You treated me with respect, but made it very clear what I needed to do and that I had screwed up. And then the next morning, when I was working my butt off double hard because I knew I was oh man, I'm so mad at myself. And you said, thank you, Johan, you worked so hard on this boat. And it was oh, okay. I'm still part of the crew. But that was, That's like on the top five list, I think, of all the boneheaded things I've done in my career. I don't know what I was thinking. I still don't know. Well, I just thought it.
Well, you're in good. You are in good company because it would be a whole nother podcast to talk about all the silly things I've done.
Well, maybe we'll wait till you're retired. Then we'll do.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, I'll talk to you next week.
Oh no!
Just kidding. Just kidding.
Yeah.
It is a wonderful thing. It's the fact that you still remember, you know, being on the boat, and you know, we have incredibly fond memories of your time aboard. I think it speaks to the strength of, you know, of what the tall ship experience is, what boats do for people. They really do build a much larger community than we're ever aware of. So
yeah,
very cool.
All right. Well, thank you, Captain Barry, for taking so much time to chat with me. I really do appreciate it. And
thank you, Johan. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Hey, if you run across, we do have space for one more deckhand this season. So if you get fired at home, though God may not be that merciful, but if you come across anyone who you think might enjoy this kind of experience, please pass the word along.
Oh, I definitely will. I absolutely will, and I'll tell everybody I can think of about what a wonderful vacation it would be to go out to Maine and go sail on the schooners. Folks, if you haven't done it, check it out. It's incredible. Or check out your local tall ship or your local maritime museum. You know, volunteer, help out. It's really just all so wonderful. Well, thank you again, Captain Barry. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Yeah, and good luck.
You're welcome,
good luck with this sailing season. Stay safe.
Yeah.
And
stay in deep water. Keep a good DR. Pay attention to wind and tide, and never forget that boats are for water and rocks are for scotch.
Well said. All right, folks, thank you so much for listening. Support this podcast if you can. And I would like to wish everybody out there fair winds and a following sea.